to the ashes of the Imperium.
Hello and welcome to Ashes of the Imperium. My name is Dan and today I'm joined by a very special guest. I'm joined by Andrew, otherwise known as Ironbeak Mercenaries, on Instagram, Twitter and various other places. Welcome Mr. Ironbeak, or welcome Andrew, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
Not at all. It's always a pleasure to chat to fellow hobbyists, especially ones like yourself, because you do something with Warhammer, which I'm a huge fan of, which is taking a small part of the Warhammer universe and like deep diving into it in a way that I think is just really impressive. And I've got a lot of time for it.
Well, you know, it's very easy to be original when no one else has done when there's not much that already exists on something.
Yeah, and I think like I'm a big fan of being a special snowflake. I like having unique armies. I like having cool unique ideas that do things a little bit differently. And you have absolutely done this with your Kroot forces. I was going to say Kroot army, but I wanted to change that there to Kroot forces, because your forces and your kind of armies have certainly expanded over the time that certainly I've been following you on Instagram. So I suppose let's cut to the chase. Like, you know, you are kind of known on Instagram and social media for being someone who does a huge amount of converting and kitbashing for Kroot models across a number of different like codexes to represent them. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose the first question really is sort of what drew you to Kroot? Where did this all begin?
Well, I guess, you know, if I'm going way back, I guess I was just starting college. Yeah, I think it's like my first year of college. And I went to a hobby store, one of the first hobby stores I'd ever been to. And they had the, not even Tau Empire box, just the Tau box, starter box there. And I was like, oh, this looks fun. And I opened it up, bought it, took it home, opened it up. And I was like, oh, I don't really want to do this. But there was a sprue of the original Kroot Carnivores unit in there. And I sold everything else except those because I kind of liked the, you know, primal look to them, the more, you know, primitive elements to them. And I guess that was kind of the beginning of it. You know, that was back when they were more a hinted at race in the Codex. You know, they talked about them, talked about the mysteries that are on their worlds. And I think one of the things that appealed to me, you know, not visually, but thematically, is they give you just enough information to keep you, you know, salivating, keep, you know, oh my gosh, what is that? There's mystery involved in them. They're shamanistic, but techie. They have secrets. Even the Tau don't really know what they're up to on their homeworld. And you know, from a creative standpoint, I really fell for that, because then they can become whatever you need them to be. The 40K universe is it's an enormous galaxy. Anything you think up could almost happen somewhere in it. And with Kroot, you know, doubly so.
Yeah. So Steve and I often refer to these little like narrative seedlings. You know, especially on the side of a codex, you might have like two paragraphs or even just like, sometimes it's just a line. Like I was listening to, oh God, what was it? Wrath of the Lost or something like that, an audiobook, a Flesh Terrors audiobook. And they referred to something like it was an audiobook, so I wasn't 100%. I need to find the actual physical book and make sure I'm like, you know, I've heard it right. But they're referring to various like alien races, and they refer to like the enigmatic Eldari or the like living tree people of something or another.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just like, wow, like living tree people in a fort, like, is that like Ents / Sylvaneth in the 40K universe? And I just thought, what an amazing army that would be. Like, imagine running that as Imperial Knights or something.
Mm-hmm.
And you could just go, like, the Sylvaneth / you know, the old Wood Elf Tree Man kit, the Sylvaneth Tree Lord kit, has, you know, I think three different variants to build from. You've got the Durthu kit, the Tree Lord Ancient, and then the generic Tree Lord. I mean, that's three variants. And then with a bit of converting here or there, you could really easily do like a, I don't know, maybe some sort of kind of like with Skaven weaponry, like the warp lightning cannon, something that's a little bit kind of, I don't know, what's the word, like agricultural, you know, not, or but slightly mystical.
Organic.
You know. Yeah. Or, yeah. You could either go organic or you could go kind of low tech.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I've even seen, it's funny you mentioned, there's a hobbyist, I Paint Yellow Fists on Instagram. And he sort of took that concept, and it was, and you know, this is one of the things I love about the Kroot. Not only are they technological scavengers and, will work for technology, for weapons, for gear, but also biological scavengers, but much more in a both more thoughtful, more intentional in how they do it than the Tyranids, but also more, I guess, conscious of it, right? You know, you have these shapers and they guide who we eat, and then they absorb specific traits they'd like. And so, you know, I Paint Yellow Fists, I think, actually did up some Kroot using those kits based on the, oh, they must have eaten some of those pseudo tree or plant life out there in the universe. And so, yeah, they're still, you know, identifiably Kroot, but their arms are made of plants and they're large and, you know, armored somewhat organically. And again, that could be a thing, right? That's sort of what they give you with Kroot. They say they can do whatever. You know, there could be a Kroot that ate some Eldar or some orcs, right? Or that have been eating sea creatures or whatever. And all of those things can exist. If you can make it can exist.
Yeah, that's quite similar to the kind of Gene Stealer cult vibe, isn't it? Or just kind of Gene Stealers in general, i.e. what does a Gene Stealer look like if it's been bred from a space marine or an orc? Or, and you know, there were those famous kind of orc Gene Stealer cult hybrids back in the day.
Yeah, or the thing they call them orc hybrids when it's Kroot. And they talk about the more orcs they ingest, they start actually becoming greener. And perhaps a little dumber.
And a little bit feistier and a bit more like English football hooligans.
Yeah, eventually I think they say they'll start calling each other boys, referring to one another as boys instead of kindred, and that's when maybe you've had a little too many orcs for lunch.
Is there such a thing as too many orcs for lunch?
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe.
I don't know, it's vegan.
Eat green, right? So yeah, so I just love the fact that you've taken something that is relatively unexplored, or certainly was at the time you kind of got into it, relatively unexplored, and really kind of made it your own across, as I say, a number of different factions. So where did as a young Ironbeak, you know, you were fascinated with perhaps the Kroot when you first got the box, and then where did it go from there? When did you start kind of exploring it in the kind of kitbash shenanigans that we see now today?
Yeah, so you know, it probably wouldn't have been too long after that. This is back in the before days. You know, there wasn't an Instagram hobby community, which, you know, I'll say is probably one of the best out there. You had to really know where to search on the internet or get White Dwarf. And it was one of those where, because the first time I had ever seen a fully converted army at all was Marco Schultz, I believe, who is very well known as High Fleet Moloch, right? You know, he did a lot of those, that first fully converted, everything's probably metal in that army, red and black Moloch army. But he also did a Kroot mercenary, Arrax Kroot Renegades. And it was Kroot who had rebelled against their Tau masters. So you had, you know, Kroot piloting sort of like half smashed open crisis suits, and you know, the fire warrior Shasui was, you know, had a Kroot behind him with a knife to his neck. And that is what made me go, wow, you can kind of make 40K your own thing entirely. And Kroot are good for that, because if you can think it up visually, you can pretty much justify it lore-wise with them because of how diverse across the galaxy. You know, the Imperium will work with them pretty much, unless it's Tyranids or, I don't know, Chaos. Pretty much anyone will, they'll take a contract with anyone. So you've got a lot of freedom there. And so I guess my very first conversion ever was literally just, you know, you've got that original Kroot kit and not a ton of options in there, but a lot of bits and bobs. And I just converted one to be holding a pistol instead of a rifle. And that was when the disease started of complete inability to put a model together the way the instructions say. And yeah, I guess that's just where it started. I didn't play a ton of 40K at the time. You know, I was in university, was busy working. But then it was probably 2008. If my dodgy memory is working, that a friend of mine convinced me to go to Austin for, I guess at the time it was Belvoir Souls Con, which became War Games Con, I think is what it's called now. And I built I used the White Dwarf, at the time, the White Dwarf Kroot Mercenary Warband
rules, which were, you know, pretty limited, but it gave you essentially a at least one choice for elites and fast attack and troops and HQs and heavy attack. I had managed to get.
And sometimes that's all you need, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you just need something to start you off, to give you a bit of a framework to operate in.
Yeah. And, it was a narrative tournament. It was, I don't know if it was Siege of Rax or whatever. And so it gave me a focus of, okay, what am I going to build? Let's make, you know, as every 40K player, let's make my first 2000 point list. You know, looking back, it was extremely simple conversions, you know, giving some units orc shooters instead of Kroot rifles, putting some old metal, probably harpy wings on the plastics to make vulturekin, right? But, you know, planted the seeds, and you know, everybody starts somewhere, and that was sort of where I started. Even had a fellow in Spain sculpt a, essentially based on the Forge World Great Narlock, a Greater Narlock to run as a barbed Hierodule in the list.
Amazing.
To give a super heavy, right? Because people were going to be bringing Titans and such as that. So I guess that's really where it started. Got to go to that event. One, super fun. The guys at Battle of Lost Souls really ran a great tournament there. Everyone that showed up, I think Dave Taylor was one of the generals of one of the two teams. So, you know, he super stand-up guy. Great to meet him, especially since, you know, especially at that time, you're looking in White Dwarf and his are the
oh, yeah, like a real hobby legend.
Oh, yeah. Even then, especially because my fantasy army started off, again, things I fell in love with the look of it and then found out later, oh, no, that's a niche thing also. It's going away. But Kislevites being a very being the thing that sort of drew me into Warhammer fantasy in the first place. And he had a very there was a White Dwarf from a long time ago where his whole army was in there. So that was really cool. And after that, it kind of, I don't know, went out of control for a little bit. And then I actually took about 10 years away from the hobby, just moving around the country, finishing school, working, and came back in, I don't know, don't even remember when that would have been, 2018 maybe. Whenever I started my Instagram and was like, okay, let's start this up again. And by that point I had, you know, played some other games, seen a lot more things online. I guess I wouldn't say became a better hobbyist, but became a lot more exposed to the different things that are out there. Yeah, experience is a good one.
Yeah. I think we all do that, don't we? And especially with conversions, there's always a time in your life when you start, especially when you're slightly younger, where you well, as you say, just slap some orc shooters on, yeah, on a town like a Kroot Carnival. You know, you just think, right, that looks good, and then you look back and you're like, no, that doesn't necessarily look as good as I thought it perhaps did.
Yeah, well, I mean, and you know, a lot of times it's just learning what are the tools out there. You know, I remember thinking a long time ago, green stuff, oh, I'll never deal with that. I'm not a sculptor. I still wouldn't consider myself one. I'm no, you know, Mr. Pink Modern Synthesis sculpting gigantic Tyranid mega creatures completely out of putty. But I think there's sort of that mental hump you have to get over of, I'm going to chop up this model I paid a lot of money for. And, you know, sometimes just go ahead and mix that green stuff. Just start. Just do it and figure it out. And I really do think it's more psychological in a lot of cases than skill-based. And once you get over that, it's, you know, charge headlong.
Yeah, it definitely opens up. I suppose it's a bit like airbrushing. You know, I know there's obviously quite a significant financial investment for airbrushing, but if you buy like a super cheap one, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be like that, or at least borrow something off a friend or a hobby store. Like I know, for example, like Element Games here in the UK, they have like airbrush stations in their game store where you can just kind of use their stuff and get to grips with it before try before you buy, as it were. And airbrushing is just one of those things where it just absolutely elevates your hobby if you have that as a tool. Like, you don't have to have it, but it just gives you so many options if you do.
Yeah, and that actually, that's a really similar analogy, right? For years, I sort of had this aversion. You know, one, I don't get as much joy out of painting as I do sculpting or kit bashing, right? I've got an image of something in my head, and it's more the shape than the colors that I'm trying to bring to life. Like, I got to get this idea out of my head. It's got to be created. I got to make it. But airbrushing was really one of those things for a long time. Like, I'm not going to get an airbrush, you know, come up with a million excuses. And then I did, and I was like, oh, why didn't I do this earlier? It's much easier than I was thinking. It's just getting over that sort of, aside from the, you know, space and finance, but it, at least for me, it was really just getting over that hump of, I can do this. It doesn't have to be just a tool of, you know, the elite pro level people.
Yeah. And I think sometimes, especially when you do watch, you know, there's a lot of really, really talented pro level people online. Back in the day, it used to be just uploading stuff to YouTube. Nowadays, it's sometimes a lot of it's behind a paywall on Patreon or something like that. But regardless of that, there's a lot of people out there that do tutorials, and they do them with airbrushes. And it can kind of, it almost suggests that it is a tool for pros like that. But like, I am the furthest from a pro painting that there could possibly be. I've still got an airbrush. And do you know what? I can do some pretty cool blends with, you know, with just a, like an amateur like me with a fairly like routine, like a normal airbrush. And especially if it's something like Eldari, where you can do some really nice like color transitions from like a kind of a turquoise up to a white on the edge, and especially like on like a Drakari plane on its wings, or on a Falcon grav tank or something like that. That looks really nice. Mm-hmm. But even if you're not doing anything complex like that, and you're just doing undercoating, like if you spray your model black, spray it white from the top, potentially with an airbrush. So I always undercoat everything with a Rattle Cam, and then I might do a Zenithal sort of highlight over the top with an airbrush. And that way, for me, it's only using one thick layer of Rattle Cam, but then a thin layer of white paint over the top. So you're not just doing two layers of Rattle Cam, because it can get quite a bit much, just depending on what primer you're using. And then if you layer a filter color over that, maybe with a little touch of glaze medium in, you get that semi-transparent color where the shading shines through. And that is not complicated. It is really, really, really basic airbrushing. And I think for a lot of armies, if you just want tabletop, you could then just paint the details and that's it done.
No, you know, I agree 100%. And I think that translates really well into kit bashing. And it's something I've, you know, everything, the more you do it, the better you get at it. And kit bashing, you know, converting models is no different. And I think a lot of what makes you get better at it is just, you know, one, learning techniques as you go, figuring out how you like to build. You know, I know people that will sketch out almost the entire model at the beginning and then try to build that. I'm, you know, sometimes I'll have an image in my head I'm trying to make. Sometimes it's an, I don't know what I'd call it, improvised design, iterative design, where I just sort of start building and see where it takes me. And sometimes, a lot of times, probably most times, that's the fun part to me, is just sort of starting with, you know, I've built models where I had one single bit and my goal was to use that. Like I want to build something around this piece. So start from there and then just start building and see where you end up. And, you know, at the end, whether it looks good or not, you know, I would love to look good, obviously. Right. But the idea was the building itself is the activity. That's the hobby, not where will I use this at an army? How would I paint this? How would this fit in my, you know, current army? It's just, let's just get this built. I think that's one of the reasons I started taking commissions, is just to be able to explore other design elements, even, you know, within Crude or Necromunda or, you know, the orc spray I got to build for the White Dwarf guys. Just getting to design and build the thing that I've got inspiration in my head that I just have to get out.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I think for me, sometimes that actually gets in the way of starting, because I have a very fixed idea of what it looks like. And sometimes that can be a bit of a barrier, because I'll start one model and it might not look look as good as what it was like in my head. And that then makes me want to give up.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's where, you know, I sort of talked about earlier, just getting over that mental hump, right? Like accepting, hey, it may not always look right. Move on. You'll build another one. And if you don't like it, build another one. Or, you know, take that apart. You at least learn something. You know, to paraphrase Sterling Archer, I do like to say a lot, if you learn something, it wasn't a mistake. And I think that applies in the hobby. Like, hey, could have done that better, but I at least learned how not to do it. So that's nice. And I have certainly done a lot of learning how not to do something in my converting.
So from Sterling Archer to Thomas Edison, perhaps, what ways have you found that don't work? Is there anything particular that you've learned over the years that I suppose like the top one lesson or top three lessons maybe?
Yeah, I've really got one big takeaway. If I have a single hobby weakness, it's tremendous impatience. It's kind of why I have an aversion to green stuff generally, is you know, when I actually have hobby time, which especially these days seems to be fleeting, and I both have time and inspiration to make something, I have to strike while the iron's hot, right? So the idea of getting some putty that's going to take 24 hours to set, and then I can't really use the rest of the model. I really have to force myself to slow down if I actually have to do some sculpting, because I'll just start messing with the model. And then before you know it, all I have is all the detail that I sculpted is now just pressed, squished flat, fingerprints. But you know, in some ways that's actually helped me come up or find new tools or new techniques where I might have used something like that before, maybe for gap filling or for filling out. Sometimes you're converting a model and outside it looks good, but the inside is hollow. So you got to fill it with something. And that's really helped me find other tools or methods that I can essentially do the same thing. And as long as it's not, you know, high detail outside exterior elements, you wouldn't be able to know. One tool I use a lot, and it's kind of hard to pick it up in pictures, but if I post, you know, a black and white photo or an in progress photo, it might look like there's gaps in a model, but there's actually a company out of Canada that makes a product called Bondic, and it's a very, very thick, viscous, UV activated resin. And it comes in a little pen with a tiny little, you know, applicator, and, learning to use that, starting with just, I'm going to fill this gap all the way up to, I've actually been able to do some rapid sculpting with it. Has been a fun learning process. And it's actually, you know, if you've never heard of it or used it, it's a great little tool. You put a davit somewhere or connect two pieces with it, blast it with its little UV light, and, you know, 3 to 5 seconds later, it's as hard as hard plastic or metal. And then you can actually file it. But it's just one of those tools that I guess my own impatience led me to go investigate. And now I seem to use it all the time.
That's Bondic UV resin glue, so BONDIC.
Yep.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
I wish they'd sell rechargeable lights, but you know, otherwise it can be very useful.
Oh, I'm sure you can get another brand's rechargeable UV lights.
Yeah, they are notoriously tight-lipped about what UV range they're using, just so that you have to buy their watch battery lights. Yeah, I'm sure someone out there, if you go on the internet, has figured it out. But
yeah, no doubt, that'll be there somewhere. And I've seen people use similar things for like glue. It's like sprue glue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, doing shavings of sprue in like a small amount of polystyrene cement, often like at the end of a bottle.
Mm-hmm.
People like pouring sprue gubbins, shavings into a pot of, as I say, glue, and that, then you've got this kind of like weird melted plastic stuff that you can use, which I suppose you could probably use it in a similar way to how one might use green stuff, but it'll dry in the same way that glue might dry.
Yeah, that's actually a Plarzoid. He's a painter and hobbyist on Insta. He actually turned me onto that relatively in just the last few years of, hey, you know, when you get to the bottom of your plastic glue, you can toss, you know, the sprue bits in there and make, you know, a muck. And that has uses. Plastic glue is one of those things I know this sounds very basic. I've only really come around to it fairly recently because, well, you know, a lot of times when you're converting, you're not necessarily working with only plastic or even the same plastic. And so I've always been more of a super glue fan myself, because I'll be, you know, I think I worked on one model once that had two or three different types of sprue plastic, two or three different types of resin, some wood, metal pieces, Plasticard, green stuff, and Milliput. And I was like, okay, well, there's super glue might just be the safest.
That's got super glue written all over it.
Yeah. Well, and also I like super glue because, I drop stuff a lot. So if it's going to drop and fall, I'd like it to break on those pre-existing joints instead of wherever it wants to.
Yeah, that's fair. And also, like, going back to what you said earlier about, iterative processes and trying new things, then absolutely you can achieve that with super glue because you can snap things back off. I used to build my Mordheim. Oh, there we go. Another episode that I've managed to get a Mordheim reference in. Fine. click
the best that up game on they the, ever made.
Up on the tracker one more. But yeah, I used to assemble my Mordheim bands with super glue so I could break arms off and put new ones on.
Yeah. Yep. One great reference, Mordheim, was the first casual campaign I ever played in. Still a big fan of Mordheim. There's actually a store near me running a season of it right now. So that's a plug, GW. Please bring back Mordheim. But yeah, I agree.
Do you think they'd bring back Mordheim whilst Warcry is still alive?
Well, yeah, you know, we've got to get the old world out there, and then we'll have space for an old world, you know, skirmish game, right?
Yeah, I wonder.
See, they should just listen to us. We're the geniuses.
They should. They should.
Yeah.
They'd sell at least two copies. There you go. So you must be looking forward to the old world with all the Kislev focus.
Yeah, I've been playing a little too much Total Warhammer 3 while I've been on the road. Excited to see where they go with fleshing out the old world. And it's a similar sort of thing to what I was saying about what you were mentioning about Crute earlier, right? See, things that they've sort of mentioned and referenced in the background, even sometimes just in the background of some artwork to sort of hint that there's a much wider world than this narrow lens we're exploring here. So very excited.
They're exploring things, you know, like, you know, back in the day when it was you just get like it was a Tsarina Katerina on the bear.
Mm-hmm. Czar Boris on the bear.
Ah, Czar Boris, that's right. Yeah, he was on the bear. Was there a Katerina model?
There was. It's older, and it was sort of one of those classic arms out to the side holding.
Do you know what? Do you know what? I think I can see it. I'm just Googling it now. I can see it.
Fourth edition, maybe?
Oh, on a horse.
Yeah. Piece cast.
Oh, no. Oh, yeah, that
it's
era.
Gorgeous. It's gorgeous.
No, it's not. It's terrible.
Don't make me go look it up. I want to keep the good memories.
Yeah, that era of cavalry heroes is just not doing it for me. Oh, I've seen a really cool conversion of a Praetorian damsel. Yes, that's cool.
Yeah.
Wow. Anyway, sorry, this just doesn't make for good radio. So you're looking forward to Warhammer Total War. Return of the Old World. Maybe this scope for Mordheim to come back. And cool, back to Crute then, shall we?
Yeah, you know, that's actually a really good segue to Crute. You know, I think I use the term lenses, and that's I've used that before talking to people. I think what the Crute are, one of the things they're really good at is they're a good lens to see the 40K world through, right? You look at narratively, they've been doing a lot with them recently with short stories. What is it? What was the book that came out? Xenologus, I believe, that was sort of the field notes of Yannis Drake, rogue trader who travels about the world. And so a lot of the stories in there about other Xenos creatures are based on his conversations with the Crute that he's worked with on the Blackstone Station. Dyat Grek, I think is his name.
It was by Darius Hinks, wasn't it? That was like a red book, wasn't it?
Yeah. It's
really cool.
If you haven't read it, it's great because it's written, you know, in person. So, you know, for all the peak GW, right? It could be wrong. It could be totally wrong. This is this guy's third hand recorded notes. You know, he's got notes in the margin like this can't possibly be a real thing. And Crute are good for that because, you know, they can interact with so many different factions. And a lot of times, not necessarily with the war porn element of 40K writing, right? Where it's just like, and then these Space Marines use 10,000 rounds and there's no personality, but hey, armor and guns, right?
Oh, yeah. So Wrath of the Lost was a little bit like that, actually. It was recommended to me by someone on Twitter because I'm a big Blood Angels fan. And I was talking about Death Company and someone said, oh, check out Wrath of the Lost. It's a really interesting book about Death Company. And like the best bits were when they were talking about, you know, the curse, like living with Sanguinius's rage within their veins, like how they balanced it and you know, the fall of their brothers to the Black Rage. But then either side of those bits, they would just be like, Grumpy Space Marine nearly rips the head off fellow Grumpy Space Marine because he looked at them the wrong way. And then like when there's the battle, you know, the various battles, it's like Grumpy Space Marine grumpily fired his grumpy bolter. And you know, like there's like some of the book is good, some of the book is just pure like Grumpy Space Marine porn.
Yeah, there was War of Secrets is a lot like that, you know. I'm like, oh, let's see, you know, let's learn about how bring in this new era of Primaris showing up out of nowhere, integrate with the very insular and secretive Dark Angels, And there was some of that. Mostly it was entertaining because there was a lot of focus on, you know, these random Imperial citizens on some world that produces, I don't know, oil. They're trying to get off world before invasion or, you know, whatever the calamity of the day is. And they try to hire some crew in a war sphere to come get them. And then they go to, you know, we're pulling Shazo Kais or whatever his name is out of stasis on the Tau battleship, and we're finding out more about the Force Sphere expansion. Oh, what are you Dark Angels up to? Oh, we're literally twirling our mustaches and being dastardly deeds people, and we're keeping secrets even from each other, and some of us are even pretending to be dead so we can pass our physical and learn this. It was just it was cartoonish. And then there'd be the battle.
Yeah, it's like a caricature, the battles,
whatever.
The caricature of a cartoon.
Yes.
Of a mockery, you know.
Yeah, they're like
of a satire.
You know, Cobra Commander, too nuanced of a character. We need to be more devious. Yeah.
Make this Space Marine's mustache twiddlier. Yes.
More wax, please. But you know, I think there've been a lot of really good short stories recently using Kroot. That lets you explore totally different things. It's a similar thing to why I love Necromunda or Kill Team, right? You don't need a giant army to tell a story here, right? So, you know, big factions in 40K, they are armies. They sort of beg to be told stories about armies. A gang in the underhive of a city on a planet in an imperium of millions of planets, right? That's a really neat little lens that you can see the world through. The squat stuck on Necromunda, as opposed to the leagues of Votan that are out there fighting across the galaxy. A Kroot bounty hunter or a Beastman bounty hunter somewhere. They're really neat ways to see other things that are out there. And it lets GW explore what I think are some of the most interesting parts of their setting without having to go whole hog on a, you know, here's your codex and 30 model kits. So that's one of the things I really like about it. And yeah, if you can get your hands on a copy of Xenologus, highly recommend it. Cause it's both entertaining and some places actually, you know, very moving. The entire section on Vespids is written as relating a story that Diet Grek tells based on memories he absorbed when he ate a Vespid that he knew for a long time that died.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
And
I didn't remember that.
Yeah, it's actually him talking about how sad he was at what the Vespid had become after the Tau had sort of absorbed them into the Empire. Because the crew's kind of tried to describe feelings he absorbed. And, you know, one is, you know, sadness and lamentation at what they lost, that the, you know, the Eries or whatever they called them were silent now. That they weren't, the buzzing and singing of the Vespids was gone. So again, that's a story you can't really tell with a lot of other species in the galaxy.
No, that's cool. I'm also impressed with how well you've, sort of going back onto the crew, specifically the models, I'm impressed with how well you've managed to bring the crew force to be relevant across a number of different factions. So is there, because currently you're working on some, I think, Mechanicus ones.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the benefits of Kroot is if you can build it, you can figure out a way to justify it in the fluff, and you can probably field it as a force. You know, I have run them different elements as within the Tau Codex, as the White Dwarf Kroot, Imperial Guard and Eldar are usually popular choices because, you know, you don't want to end up, unless you're doing something very specifically, you kind of want to stay true to the fact that these are lithe, quick, avian creatures, right? So Eldar, obviously a very popular choice. For the most recent iterations of the Ironbeaks, I've really dived into the sort of obsession with technology that's resulted from sort of the circumstances the Ironbeaks found themselves in after the disastrous Force Sphere expansion. So, you know, I've got both Knights and Chaos Knights and Admech models I built there. And, you know, I guess you don't have to. I, as much as I use 3D printed hands and heads to give more options, because until the Farstalker Kinband came out, I think there were only four different crew heads, maybe five. Not a lot of choices. I do like to use, not just try and stick to actual GW kits. I don't know, maybe that's because I'm an old timer and people these days don't seem to have a problem with that. But also I'd like the challenge of trying to use at least some elements of the original kit
in the conversion. And that's as simple as, you know, for my Skitarii stand-ins, it's basically just Kroot legs and heads and a few arms on a Skitarii body. You know, make them a little taller, and there you go. And some of that is if I ever intend to play, I also kind of want to make it easy for an opponent to be able to look at that and be like, oh, that's this. Oh, that's that. Okay, got it. That's actually one of the selling points on AdMech when I started is I started with that first AdMech codex. And there were really only two options that any given base size could be in the army book. And each of those two options was usually just a dual build kit. So if it was on a 25 millimeter, it was Skitarii. If it was on 32, it was Electropriest. If it was on 40, it's going to be Sicarian of Infiltrators or Rustalkers. If it's on a 60, it's either the big, what, the Castellan Stompy Boys, or it's the Treaded Guys, the Cataphrons. I don't particularly like them.
No, I'm not a huge fan of those models personally, but those tracks are perfect for a number of different things.
Yeah, and then you've got your big giant base. And, you know, I think the first vehicle I built was a counts as Dune Strider, mostly because I love, what is it, 100 millimeter, 120 millimeter base? It basically, it lets you build a diorama.
Absolutely.
In a game. I think when Iron Beaks were first in White Dwarf, that was one of the models, and I basically took the turret and put it on the treads of my favorite GW model kit, which is the I don't remember what the 40K copyrightable name is, but it's the two little tractors and then the crane thing that was used in a lot of kill team kits. But I put it on a set of those tractors, have it pulled by two crew docks, and it's kind of a Western stagecoach look to it. Like, okay, this is what we've got.
Amazing.
And you know, there's I use the Diet Grek walking along the side with a Kroot Hound. There's a guy on the back reloading a double barrel Kroot rifle manually. It lets you tell a whole lot of story, but you can also use the model. And of course, now I've also made models where I just came with the idea and I'm like, oh good, it'll fit on that base. I like being able to do Sidonian things. Yeah, those are on some special base.
Oh, the Dragoons.
Yeah, the Dragoons and the Iron Striders, I believe.
Yeah, they're really cool.
So it's both easy for me to keep track, and also, you know, I don't think I'd ever actually played them until Adepticon this year. And it was very easy to explain to everyone. I'm like, hey, small base troops, those are the small base troops. The big guys that are using that have Castellan legs and are on Castellan size bases, those are Castellans, right?
Guess what? They're Castellans, yeah.
So it speeds that up.
That's what I like about armies like yours, is that it is very much yours. And one of my issues is I have a bit of a kind of psychological thing where I feel like I'm wasting space in my hobby room, or I'm wasting money, like, because I'm not using it, so I want to sell it to try and recoup some of the money that I spent on it. You know, things like that. I just have this weird like psychological thing where if I'm not specifically using it or into it, I kind of want to get rid of it.
Mm.
That's then balanced with my like aggressive, you know, ADHD and my inability to stick to a task like selling models. So I'm both a a hoarder and someone that hates hoarding things. So yeah, it's a fun place to be sometimes.
You know, self-destructive or anything.
Absolutely, right. but yeah, this isn't a therapy session, so we won't dive too much into that. But whereas, you know, if I start building something and it's just a bunch of Space Marines, then if I don't like it, I'll sell it.
Yeah.
And then inevitably in 6 months' time, I'll be like, oh, you know, what would be really cool would be an all Phobos armored strike force.
That would be.
What have I done with all my Phobos Marines? Like, oh, I've sold them all. What an idiot. Whereas with your stuff, like, it's all really, really unique and yours. So unless someone specifically wants that army, and if they did, you could probably charge a fair amount for it. But unless someone really, really specifically wants that army, you're not really going to stick it on eBay and sell it for, you know, 50% of retail like you might do some other stuff. So there's no impetus to sell it, because without the right buyer, it's just a unique converted army that's yours.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, and I build things because I had to get the idea out. And sometimes it's I build it and then I give it away or sell it. I think one of my hobby projects that my partner was probably the most happy with was I did a series of commissions, probably 20, 30 models. And they were Iron Beak envoys, right? So there was a huge Kroot community out there, bigger than you would think. I guess not huge, you know, not as many Space Marine players, right? Because those are the poster boys. But, you know, we've got a couple hundred deep Discord that's all about the Kroot-vasion, right? The idea that sort of a more of a pretext, right? Like, oh, the idea is that Tyranids are attacking
Peck, right? Their homeworld. And all the crew across the galaxy have to come back. So your crew can look like whatever. They're from anywhere, fighting anybody in any part of the galaxy. And so there's, you know, dozens, hundreds of Kroot armies that people are making. Some very simple, using the Tau Codex. Some elaborate. I think that Kroot guy on Instagram has like 8 different Kroot armies, all very different. Sorry, getting sidetracked there. But sort of the point of all that was I came up with this idea of the envoys of like, oh, the Iron Beaks are sending out envoys, you know, messengers to different, customized to the different kindreds out there to try and get them to come back. And so it gave me a sort of an opportunity to build 20, 30 one-off models that I then got to, they don't have to live on the shelf at my house. They then get to go to someone as a commission. And it's everything from, you know, I had individual kind of creepy looking little advisor guy with his hands behind his back to all the way up to a counts as Baneblade that one of my teammates used at Adepticon this year, which was being pulled by a big Maw Crusher.
Yes, was that a Baneblade, was it?
Yeah, well, no, it was a the Plasma Cannon or Storm Blade, perhaps?
Yeah.
With the big Plasma Cannon. Of course, that's Felix the Crazy. He's sort of the, if you've seen a 3D designed Kroot stand-in or creature or model, he's almost definitely the one that did it. He's incredible. And of course, he took that model and cranked it up to 11, put in sound effects, and it lights up and it glows in the dark. And the sound effect is actually like the cannon charging up for a few seconds and then firing. Yeah, it was really cool to actually see it in person. And that's one of the things I love to see is like, okay, here's my work. Someone else take this as a jumping off point.
That's amazing. I love it.
The sort of collaboration there, creative collaboration can be very invigorating.
So let's touch on 3D printing now, because I think we've mentioned it a couple of times, and there you've mentioned there Felix's amazing sculpts for Kroot stuff. I think I'm of a similar view to you, which is I see 3D printing as a way to enhance existing models.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a big fan of I'm a big fan of the products that Games Workshop puts out. So I don't necessarily feel the need to, you get an interesting vibe sometimes on Facebook groups of like, you know, sod this, I'm just going to 3D print everything.
3D printer goes brr.
Yeah, 3D printer goes brr, which is cool. You know, all power to you. If that's your vibe, then go for it. Like, I enjoy playing events at Games Workshop's events, so at Warhammer World. So if I'm ever going to use 3D printing in armies that I'm going to use there, I have to be really careful. So, you know, if it's just like a shoulder pad here or there, or like a converted, you know, Space Marine backpack or something for like a Tech Marine, you know, that kind of stuff. You know, I don't want to just do like 3D printed third party armies. That said, I totally would. There's a great designer called Reptilian Miniatures, and they do really cool sculpts for things like Praetorian guard heads. Now, I would love to do a full Praetorian Astra Militarum army, just all the new Cadians, but with Praetorian kind of pith helmets. Mm-hmm. Like, that would be really cool. But there's no way I'd be able to then play that army at a Games Workshop event, which is fine because there are plenty of other events that I can use them at. And so I think I strike a balance between obviously using the Cadian models, like, and I will build them from Games Workshop Cadians because I like working with plastic as well. I think it's a really flexible medium. You know, it's easy to chop up, easy to kitbash. When you do then use plastic glue, and I know I'm talking to a super glue fan and a kitbasher extraordinaire, but for me, the joints that you can make, you know, you can cut it off at the wrist and then use another plastic hand and use a bit of plastic glue, and then you've got a really secure, solid joint. For me, that's useful when I'm kitbashing. And then with, you know, a resin head, it kind of can really can change the character of the army. So certainly building, using 3D printing to enhance existing models is probably kind of what I would certainly approach it from. Is that something would you say that you agree with, or are you kind of more happy to kind of use more STLs in your own?
Yeah, so I've got one or two models that I got as STLs just because I thought really cool, and you know, I've even printed some with the intent of using them, but I've never actually gotten around to the doing that. I think I sort of agree with you. I see 3D printing, and I'm not saying this is exclusive. You know, there's a lot of, as you say, great designers out there, people that want completely custom armies, and you know, maybe they don't have the time to sit or it is extremely time intensive to fully convert an army. I started years ago on one and I don't have it fully done, right? So the idea is very intriguing to have a custom printed army that really is going to look uniquely you, right? Maybe some other people out there bought the STLs, but the odds that you're going to come across one of those in the wild is pretty slim. So I definitely understand that. For me, 3D printing, I sort of see the same way that, I guess in the olden days, resin bits from third parties were used. In my mind, it is an extra tool that can do a couple different things. One is it fills gaps, right? Like, hey, when all you had was the original Crew Carnivore kit with, you know, four different sets of legs, five torsos, and five or six heads, one new head mixed with that, two or three new heads completely change the tone of some models, right? And then you could have, I think my first Vulturekin had heads with little, kind of look like scouters from Dragon Ball Z. And it just totally changed what they look like with a very minor little swap. I also think they're extremely useful as time savers. I can sculpt Kroot hands from scratch. I've had to do that a lot. It's not super quick and easy. If I can just get a whole bag full of Kroot hands that are grasping a basic hilt or just a handle and then attach a weapon to it, I could do that manually, but that just saved me a whole lot of time. And then, as I mentioned earlier, I'm a very impatient hobbyist and I don't usually have free time and inspiration overlap. So things that can, shortcuts like that, I think are really helpful. But then I still have that sort of thing in the back of my head. I was talking about, I like to try and use the GW parts. Now that the Farstalker Ken Band is out, one incredible kit, absolutely gorgeous. Not even just because it's Kroot, just an extremely well-designed kit. So much character in it. And they're a little fiddly, but not too fiddly to try and get together. They also did a really good job of making it versatile and I wouldn't say backward compatible, but it doesn't take too much work to use some of the bits and bobs that come with that, with the traditional carnivore kit, to really get diversity there. I don't like going back to models, but I've had this overwhelming desire to go back and remove a lot of the 3D printed heads I use and just replace them with some of the Farstalker heads, because not necessarily they look better. They just, oh, those are official heads. Maybe I'll use those now. I've used these at official GW events and no one really notices because it's so close to the original. But that's there. And I think for me and my hobbying, that's where 3D printing is so helpful. I brought up the Countess Stormblade, right? 3D printing off a head, Felix 3D printed off a head and sent it to me that was perfectly scaled for that Maw Crusher. One, saved a lot of time. Two, really changed the look of that creature. Several people have done Maw Crusher conversions for Kroot, but usually it's requires green stuffing over the mouth, and it is a lot of work to sculpt a whole new head. So a lot of them, I wouldn't say look the same, but they have a similar tone to them. And actually, one of our teammates, that Kroot guy, he had two different ones. They were his. He was playing Countess Genestealer Cults, and they were his Rock Grinder and the other thing. And right next to it was this similar creature, almost identical creature, except for a different head. Pulling the war rig, and it just looked totally different because even just something such as the head, a big long head instead of a short snouty head, changed the lines of the design enough. I think in instances like that, it's really useful for me. But I definitely get the appeal of people that would like something entirely custom. And then
especially when you're facing like, do you buy a Great Narlock, mm-hmm. do you buy a Great Narlock off eBay knowing that it's a recast?
Yeah.
Or do you try and find one in an original Forge World bag and pay five times the price?
Yeah.
Or do you find an STL? And I think I'd personally prefer to support an artist that's designed a model electronically and 3D print it rather than, support someone who's, selling recasts.
Yeah. And as I say, that's sort of a gap filling, right? Like I'm not going to speak for him, but I've talked pretty extensively with Felix the Crazy on a bunch of things. He was on our team and he's sort of got a similar design to that. He doesn't want to, he's not ever designed anything that replaces the GW kit. Even some of the models he's designed, he's like, no, that's just a torso. You'd still need the legs or you'd still need the, the whatever to make it. And that's sort of one of his things on one of his sort of philosophies is I'm filling the gap. But you know what? If GW showed up tomorrow and said, hey, we're making new great Narlox now, get rid of yours. Okay, that's awesome. Thank you. We've all been waiting for this for so long. You know, filling the gap is great, but man, it'd be really cool to get some official support, which is why I'd still go out and buy all the releases for things I like when they do come out to, you know, in my tiny little way, show there's a market. But then there's some times where 3D printing is the only viable way for me to do something. So I did, what are the AdMech little cavalry guys with the little, you know,
The Cerberus riders?
Yeah. So I was like, oh, I want to do, you know, little Western U.S. cavalry looking croot riding giant croot hounds. I'm not going to sculpt individually really big croot hounds, but it was very easy to find an STL and just scale it up to, I think, 180% or something. And then you have something that fills that base out. And on top of this croot hound is a croot with his little kepi and his two little pistols. And he's rooting and he's tooting. And
he's rooting and he's tooting.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. Love it. That is, that's very Civil War era, isn't it?
And, you know, that's another one of those designs where the bit I started off that design with was those little kepi hats. I was like, oh, I want to use these in something. How am I going to do it? Oh, I know what I'll do. I'll have cowboy croot riding giant dogs.
Cowboy croot. Love it. So if you were going to, you know, if you're going to give any advice on anyone wanting to get involved in the world of croot, what was it you referred to it as? The croot invasion?
The croot invasion, which is probably not great marketing because it's hard to say and spell, but you know, that's
hashtag croot invasion.
Yeah, hashtag croot invasion.
If you wanted to, you know, give any words of encouragement or advice to people who want to get involved in the croot invasion, maybe they are similarly enamored with these quirky little bird lizards from 40K, you know, what advice would you give?
You know, I guess first, like, welcome, right? I wouldn't say it's an insular community, but it's a community that's used to working together to try and come up with ideas, share bits, share, hey, guess what, guys? I just converted this model to look like a croot. What are your thoughts? And like, oh, wow, that's awesome. You know, I think one of the guys in that community was one who's like, hey, here's a really quick and easy technique for converting human hands into croot hands, because, you know, that's one thing a lot of crooters have, I have a mental block in my brain. I'm like, croot only have four fingers. That doesn't have the right amount of fingers. It doesn't look croot to me. And I know that's not totally rational, but that's just a thing that a lot of people have. So sharing techniques and ideas. But you know, one of the best things you do is just, you go on Instagram and search, just scroll through the hashtag croot-vasion, and the just raw variety of ideas and models and concepts that came out of a single GW kit that's old enough to drink in the United States. I think it's now 22 years old, the original Carnivore kit. It's very, you know, at the time it was very groundbreaking with all the extra bits. Now it's looking dated, but you know, it's really, if you can imagine it, you can build it, and it doesn't necessarily seem, I guess, snowflakey, because there's probably examples of that somewhere in the lore, right? I think the Xenologist book had like six or seven different types of various croot mutations that they talk about, including a big hulking croot orc hybrid, or one that, you know, was covered in scales like a horn-tailed lizard. So just sort of see what other folks have done, and then you know, reach out to people. One of the things that I learned early on in the hobby, thankfully I had such a good experience, and I know that not everyone has, but the ability of most hobbyists, even what you might consider a, you know, a quote famous hobbyist, not that I'm one of those, but right, like talk about, say, Dave Taylor, right?
Hashtag Warhammer celeb. Oh, is that a claim then?
No, God, please no. but so many people that are passionate about the hobby and really love that creative spark also have the, you know, that sort of built-in fire to expound upon that, to share that. You know, when I started, I was inspired by a bunch of people. Owaka Croot is one of the ones who, you know, before I built my first croot, already had fully converted croot up on his thing. And many, many, many years later, I reached out to him again and said, hey, you know, we're trying to put together an all croot team for Adepticon. I don't know if you even still play, but it'd be really cool if you did, because, you know, I think I vaguely remembered he lived somewhere near Chicago. And he got more active in it. And you know, hobbyists are people too. And a lot of them just want to just help other people do fun hobby stuff. So yeah, I guess all that's a meandering way to say, don't feel like you can't reach out to a hobbyist. who's doing something you like and ask for thoughts or tips or feedback. You know, I got a message. Oh, I was buying something secondhand off a local guy the other day. And he's like, oh, yeah. I was like, oh, what are you looking for this model or whatever? And he said something about, I was looking for 200, but, you know, for you, 150. I was like, why? He goes, oh, well, you know, I can't remember. I don't even remember the interaction. He's like, oh, 10 or 15 years ago, when I was building my first army, you gave me some advice on something at the store. And I really, you know, that really shaped what I do. And I make custom and paint stuff now and everything. And I was like, wow, that's awesome. I love that just being positive and just trying to help a fellow hobbyist was that impactful. And shit, that's cool. Better feedback than any, oh, I like this model that you made kind of feedback.
That is lovely. That is really heartwarming.
Yeah, and again, I had those good inspirations. Those sort of, you know, hobby mentors coming up, and you know, if I can play that role for someone else, that's fantastic. And I think a lot of hobbyists feel that way.
Yeah, no, absolutely, I completely agree. I think that's a really cool story. Although having just said, you know, it's a lot better than saying I like that model, there is one model on your Instagram relatively recently that I am a big fan of, and that is your orc spray.
Oh yeah,
which you made for White Dwarf.
Yeah, that was in I think it ended up getting in, maybe it was this past December's White Dwarf, November.
White Dwarf 482, your Instagram says.
Okay, yeah, it was it started as an idle discussion. I had a chat with friend of mine that works over there, and he was like, he just threw out the, hey, if you were going to make a Chinork, right? So if you roll on the, and you go into the kill team and you can roll what your base is, right? And one of the base options for orcs is a Chinork, and it has some in-game effects, I think, but it's not a model. Like, it's not a thing that's supposed to be on the board. He's like, how would you build that? He's talking about different things. I was like, oh, I'd use a Valkyrie to start. You know, it's a giant. That's a giant flyer. I built one years ago for an Adeptus Arbites army I was doing. And anyone who's ever built one and then said they didn't run around their house going whoosh, whoosh while swinging around, they're liars. It's super fun to do that with this kit.
But Valkyrie is, I think, one of the best old kits that Games Workshop do.
I mean, for the age of it, it's so fantastic.
Yeah, they're so cool. And it for me, it instills so many cool memories of them coming out and being like quite expensive. Back in May 2009, when the 5th edition Imperial Guard Codex got released, was when I was getting back into Warhammer as a young 21-year-old. So May 2009, I was finishing university in Nottingham, no less, having just spent 3 years in Nottingham, when I did that classic thing of, you know, teenage boy being like, nah, Warhammer's not cool. Like, I'm not into Warhammer because that's for nerds. Like, did I waste my opportunity there? Perhaps not. Perhaps I wouldn't necessarily have done very well at university had I been, you know, fully focused on Warhammer at the time. Not that I did particularly well at university as it was. But so I was getting into 40K, and I chose to get back into 40K with the Imperial Guard. And it was so the Valkyrie for me is really kind of reminds me of that era. It was still quite a big model in terms of like lots of models have come out since, like the Imperial Knight and Super Heavies and things like that. But to have like a massive flyer was a big deal. And it was, I don't know, 35, 40 quid, whatever it was, which isn't that expensive. But to, you know, a student who's, you know, got a student debt and, you know, doesn't really have a proper job yet or has got a low paid graduate job, you know, it was a chunk of money. And so I remember really kind of lusting after them and being like, wow, they're so cool. And then like you had the Forge World Vendetta conversion kit that came out.
Yeah. And the Vulture.
And then the Vulture as well, which has got the kind of amazing like central turbine, which is just a stunning model as well. But yeah, it really kind of sends me back to those days. And then in my early 20s, I then did an Elysian army. So again, this must be, I don't know, 2012, 13 kind of time. And I did a full Elysian Dropship army with about 7 flyers. I think I had 5 Valkyries, maybe 3 Valkyries of Vendetta, and then a Vulture, what's the one with the Avenger Gatling cannon at the front that's a bit like an A-10 Thunderbolt?
The what in the front?
The sort of the big Gatling cannon.
Oh, the Avenger, cannon. Yeah, Avenger, yeah.
I think it's called The Avenger.
Is it?
Avenger Strike Fighter. It's kind of like
the Avenger Strike Fighter.
It looks like a backwards Stuka, but with a big A-10 cannon for nose.
Exactly that. Yeah, with the kind of wonky wings.
Gold wings.
So, and I did it all in digital camo. So I spent ages doing digi camo with these little sticker things that you could get online. And it was glorious. Like, I allied in a drop pod full of Ultrine Stern God veterans because that fit the narrative. Not.
No, it's because I took it to sixth edition. They were probably quite good.
And I remember taking it to a tournament, and it was when flyers were just like so broken, and everyone was like, you know, on the internet, people were just like, oh yeah, you know, you just absolutely wiped the floor, and I got absolutely destroyed. I just completely fluffed up that event, and it was so embarrassing. But anyway, so going back to the point is, Valkyrie's got a big soft spot in my heart for that, because it does remind me of my early 20s when I was getting back into Warhammer. And I'm a huge fan of your Orc one. As someone that is slowly amassing a bunch of like Imperial vehicles that I'm slowly turning into Orc vehicles, I kind of want to do a full commando army where each truck is slightly different. Mm-hmm. So I've made one from the Tau Rocks already. I want to make one from a Goliath. I want to make one from I'm trying to try and get hold of some like the old Forge World like enclosed cabs for the truck, and just do like different style trucks, and just but have them all painted very similarly so they're cohesive, and then have something like I don't think I'll go Chinook. I won't go as mad as you have, but like a converted Valkyrie. I saw Greggles did an amazing, like, not a biplane, but like a dual hold plane. I think you did something similar with a couple of the ABMEC flyers.
Yeah, I did that. That's the first time I saw the ABMEC flyer. My thought was, I need to build that, but as a dual hold fighter. And then I had that idea stuck in my head for like 2 years before I finally did it. But that was fun. Real Crimson Skies inspired thing.
Dual. Yes. Oh, I love it. It's so cool. Isn't it?
But yeah, I know this has surprised a lot of people. That's my first orc anything I've ever built. I've always sort of loved the orcs, and talk about, you know, hobby inspirations growing up. When I first started playing 40K, there was a local guy, and he was every good stereotype of an orc player you could possibly believe. You know, even before the current battle wagon kit was out, you know, he had the resin, he had the armor cast models, he had, I don't even know, Forge World mates over the time. And it's always just mad, crazy stuff. And I love that orcs have so much fun. Orc players, good orc players, seem to have as much fun at pretend war as the orcs are having at real war. So a chance to build that, you know, once I got the idea stuck in my head, I think I built the entire thing in a week or two. And that's really just like 2 weekends. Smashing together the whatever the orc fighter Fighta Obama or Fighta is called, with a Valkyrie kit, and just getting to do all those fun little visual storytelling elements that a good orc army or model gets to do. You know, having each propeller have a different number of blades on it, but it works, of course, because the orcs think it worked. There's even the model presents a quandary, and it is that the two orcs in the front, if you really zoom in, none of the controls that are holding are connected to anything. They're not glued down. They're just holding sticks and joysticks and controls. And one of them's shooting, and one of them's using a handbrake on the side of the vehicle, even though it's flying.
That's amazing. And I love that also, that as a modeler, you're like, yeah, that's right. These controls aren't attached to anything. I don't need to try and find a really awkward, like, angled arm for this hand to connect this, like, lever, because it doesn't matter.
No, and then if you actually look at it, I think I don't have it up, but one of the pictures that was in White Dwarf, you can see they painted up the orc in the seat behind the front pilot. He's just playing Galaga on his. It's just a little, like the little ship at the bottom shooting the little rows of aliens at the top. You know, it was very tiny.
Oh, Space Invader.
Yeah, Space Invader, sorry. And then behind them, inside the hull, is where there is a Grot piloting the entire thing. he's actually got controls and little sensors. You can see he's got screens and stuff in front of him. And he's also wearing his little flight cap and everything. But then that presents the question. So they are not flying because he's flying, but they think they're flying. So are they flying? Yeah.
Love it.
And then there's a door gunner, and he's easily the dodgiest part of the entire build, because as I said, it was my first orc build at all. And I didn't own any orcs, which means, so for pilots, great. I've got plenty of pilot models to use between the actual orc flyer and then the orc, the orc ground vehicle. That's the crashed flying thing. I can't.
The boom decker snazwagon.
Yeah, boom decker. Man, you know all the things. Yeah, I had that pilot, right? But I didn't actually have any orc models, so I had to. There's a guy, a local guy, a few blocks from me, but he had some miscellaneous like fantasy orc bits, and so the door gunner is like the head from one of the pilots. It's a old 40k orc boy body. The legs are actually from old fantasy orc boys. Don't look too close at it. It's horrible. His proportions are totally, totally ridiculous. But he's standing in that door with his little, you know, belt fed gun yelling into the microphone, probably yelling literally, daka, 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 daka. I don't know. It's fun stuff. You can do like that. One of the bombs is literally just a grot attached to the bomb connector, and he's holding a grenade.
I love it. I mean, you can do a lot of cool stuff with orcs like that, can't you?
Yeah, it was the one bad thing about this build is it really made me want to make more orcs.
Oh, yeah.
And I've neither the time or the space for a bunch more orc vehicles, but it was sure fun.
The Megatrack Scrap Jet. Is, of course, the one you're thinking of, which I've always wanted to just convert into a Decker Jet.
Yeah, oh, yeah. I actually, the rest of him is going to be converted into a flying vehicle, probably a biplane. Because that just, why not?
Yeah, that's definitely got like Spitfire vibes or biplane vibes, doesn't it?
I definitely gave in to some of my, if I have another hobby vice, it's unnecessary magnetization and compartmentalization of vehicles, even sometimes just individual models. So do the propellers need to be able to turn on this thing? And also the engines they're attached to be able to pivot up and down? No. But did I magnetize the hell out of it so they could? Absolutely. Does the lid come off and is held together by tension from some green stuff tubes? Yes. Does it need to? No. But if it doesn't come off, you can't see inside. So, you know, what's the point? In the end, I don't know if I went far enough on orcifying it, if I really am honest with myself, but it was a good first outing.
Well, perhaps then when I build mine, we can do a little collab and you can give me some assistance in how best to orcify a Valkyrie.
Hey, as long as the final product lives at your house, I am fine with that.
Absolutely. Well, it's been fantastic chatting to you. I really appreciate you taking the time and chatting all things crew and all things kit bash across a number of different species and armies. Have you got any shout outs or anything like that? Of course, you're at Ironbeak_mercenaries on Instagram and Twitter, aren't
you? Yep, that's me. And I don't really plug anything, but you know, I think it'd be really good if people would follow and listen to Ashes of the Imperium, the podcast. I think it's great.
I'll stop at you.
You know, if I'm going to plug anything, it's that if there are people out there and they do Kroot or they want to do Kroot and they're looking to get it and they happen to have Discord, shoot me a message on any of my socials, and I can send you a Kroot-vasion Discord invite link. Very, very helpful, open community in there. A lot of people just trying to help other people pursue their obsession with a minor faction in 40K.
So all that remains is to wish everyone a very happy hobbying. And instead of perhaps saying keep calm and crusade on, we should say keep calm and Kroot on.
Keep calm and Kroot on.